I really believe that good quality care for any chronic illness or any illness is an important social justice mission. Because one of the things that we know is that good quality care can improve, you know, how people live. You know, we call it health, but how people feel every day when they wake up. With things like mental health, as we've seen from the prior talks, how people relate to their families, their loved ones. So there can't be anything more of a social justice issue than how you feel every day and how to improve that. This is a photograph. This is a talk about a partnership that's an NIH-funded study. So it's a little bit unusual for partnerships. It did grow out of about 5 or 6 years of pilot work before it was funded, and it really relies on about a decade or more of relationships. But this is an NIH-funded study. It's called Community Partners in Care, and this is a photograph from one of our conferences at Holman United Methodist Church, where we do a lot of our work. So there's no conflicts of interest to report. I don't know if that's always true, because this is NIH funded. We like to get articles and more grants. So, but from a pharmaceutical company industry point of view, there are no conflicts of interest to report. There are a lot of partners. You know, I didn't really put an authorship list down because there are just so many people involved. This doesn't even get to it. And what we're really trying to do is try to figure out how we build a village for depression care. There's tons of funders, and because of time in the talk, I'm not really going to go through them. But some of the main partners that I have is our Healthy African American Families. Loretta Jones, she's a community health advocate in South Los Angeles, who is very active in APHA, who is a very strong partner. She's not here. Queens Care Health and Faith Partnership, which is a nurse-run church faith-based program. Behavioral Health Services, which is the largest contractor provider of substance use services in Los Angeles County, is also a partner. And there's just so many more. A lot of people at RAND and UCLA. Why this is important? Depression actually turns out to be the largest cause of disability in the world among adults. So if you compare somebody with depression to someone with a heart attack or stroke, they actually have about equal amounts of disability, right? You're not going to tell somebody who's had a heart attack, get up and do your job, right? Next day, right? But for depression, for some reason, you're like, buck up, get over it, right? And, but you know, it's really different. Depression's different because it affects people between the ages of 18 and 65 as opposed to over the age of 65, like heart attack, stroke, or cancer. So it has a lot of impacts on how much money you make, whether you get an education, how you take care of your family. We know things work. Evidence-based treatments work. Therapy and medications work quite well. I'm not going to go over the details of that. In primary care, specialty care are major sectors for depression care. So people like you who has a family practice, probably a good 20% of your practice is mental health or more. Alcohol abuse and depression and anxiety. We know that people in primary care don't get the type of care that you would get in specialty mental health care. There are lots of ways to fix that. These programs are called collaborative care approaches. They've actually been shown to eliminate health disparities in both process and outcomes of care for things like depression. In underserved communities, agencies like primary care don't exist. Specialty mental health don't exist. Where people go to get so-called care are social service agencies, churches, community centers, senior centers. They're not care providers per se, but they essentially take over. And so how do you build care in underserved communities using the kinds of approaches that our partners have told us we need to use? This is very quickly. Evidence-based quality improvement programs for depression can be shown to eliminate health disparities with improvements in clinical functioning, employment outcomes, and reduce adverse life events over 2 to 5 years. It's actually been shown that quality care can increase your net worth by 15%, and also improve your likelihood of employment. We don't know how to improve these quality improvement programs in areas where there are no healthcare providers, or very few. These are programs, this is based on a study that I didn't do, obviously I'm too young, Partners in Care, which is done by my mentor, which is a quality improvement program. The top basically shows that if you improve quality of care in primary care clinics, that you can reverse the health disparities in outcomes. So outcomes for depression care will lead to, I think, about five times improved likelihood of receiving good quality depression care, and the improvements in minorities versus whites, actually minorities improve at 5 times of whites. And this is based on symptom scores. So how do we get high quality care out there for people who need it most? How do we get in a way that respects people's values? How do we do it in a way that might be sustainable? So how do we go into a community, actually improve things and keep it there? And how do we show that we did make a difference, right? How do we conduct high quality science to show that these things work? That's the challenge. Because we know one of the things about community work is a lot of community does great work, but unfortunately, because they don't have the kind of science behind it, you can't take a picture of it and prove that it works in the way that the policymakers always want it to work. I mean, stories are always nice, but they like data. Fair or not, that's the truth. And that's what we've learned. And, you know, as a researcher who's starting to work in communities, you know, the research that we do is not relevant unless we really bring in a lot of partners. And so it's nice to have these kind of partnerships. They're not easy. So Community Partners in Care is a picture of some of the conferences we have. We've had a number of conferences where I think we've had, I don't know, probably 1,000 people plus attend these conferences. It's an NIMH-funded R01, actually it's two R01s, using a community partner participatory research approach in all phases, basically partner in every phase from funding, before the funding, during the research, how do we do things. We have a steering council of partners and researchers oversee the project. This is reinforced through a memorandum of understanding that's signed by all the institutions. This is a randomized controlled trial of a participatory research approach as an approach to disseminate and implement evidence-based depression care at community-based agencies. These are some of the partners. I'm not going to go through all that again. Some of the core principles, which everybody who does participatory research knows, these relationships are both individual but mainly institutional, and that's an important thing to recognize. We adhere to core principles of power sharing respect. We really try to find the win-win, and we support both community and academic capacity development. What does that mean? You know, I as an academic member learn how to work in communities, and communities learn about science. We have action plans. We have work groups. There's a whole organizational structure that really guides this, and I'm not going to get into that, but Ms. Jones and Dr. Wells have written about this in JAMA, and I'm happy to tell you about the articles later. What we do when we get engaged with communities, we share, we listen, respect differences. We honor written agreements. When we say something, we try to keep our promises. We structure activities to level playing fields, and we always embrace everybody, not just as a subject, but as a partner. So everybody's a participant, everybody's being studied, from the senior PI to the person who's homeless, who's participating in the project on a work group. We also align resources and funding to fit principles and support win-wins from everybody. That's a challenge. This is what the study is. It's a three-phase study. Phase one is a partnered planning phase. We spent 2 years just planning what the study was. The NIMH was kind of intrigued by this, where we had a policy advisory board, we had community dialogues, we're in different spas, where we had big meetings where we asked people about depression, where should services be located. Essentially, what we're trying to do is compare two conditions. One is an adapted toolkit for depression care that was used for primary care that's going to be adapted for lots of different agencies, community service agencies, food banks, churches, senior centers, you name it, including therapy and case management, medication management, versus sort of a low-impact technical assistance, which SAMHSA might do, where you do a training and then have webinars and different components of the toolkit. And the first one was developed in about over 5 or 6 months of planning with agencies where we would adapt these toolkits. And then the second one was just kind of implemented as we went along and had webinars. We're currently in the randomized trial, which we call the Valley phase of the project, where we are doing the randomized trial. We are, you know, surveying people both at the agency level, administrators and providers, as well as clients. And we're looking at client outcomes at 6 and 12 months, as well as 12-month and 24-month provider and administrator outcomes. We did a lot of things to change this in order to adapt this to communities, what community felt. For example, what does community mean? That was up for grabs, and that was a two-month discussion, actually. One of the discussions we had was actually in LA, services by the county are delivered by service planning areas, and that's the definition. We changed the agencies because the agencies, we quickly discovered that in South Los Angeles, there are no primary care. There's no mental health. So we had to add things like what we call community trusted locations, parks and rec centers, and they were at the table the whole time, senior centers. We have churches. We have a barber shop. We have a beauty salon in South Los Angeles. Providers, what's a provider? Clearly there are not enough doctors. There's not enough social workers. We started going to substance use counselors, certified, non-certified, and we started going to lay health workers. And not even health workers. I mean, I think health, they're good-hearted community people. And also we started including homeless and people with HIV. And now I have, I have 5 minutes, not that bad. We changed our intervention. Originally we were gonna have a care as usual group. In a randomized controlled trial, anybody who's familiar with randomized controlled trials, they like a placebo group or a care as usual group. And this was a big fight, actually. Very, very vigorous discussion where we talked about, the community said, that's not fair. We can't do that. You can't do an observational study in my community. Are you kidding? All these people are hurting and you're gonna not do anything about it? And you know what to do? So we had to change our control condition or care as usual condition to some sort of assistance, which actually goes well beyond what the county or the state or the feds ever do for providing depression care training to these types of agencies, unadapted, of course. We did this over a year, and that period's just ending. We had a lot of issues around recruitment. Who do we recruit? You know, one of the things that our survey group, actually the RAND survey group said is too expensive to recruit the homeless. How do you keep track of them? And, you know, the community partners insisted, we really, if we're not going to be able to show these effects on the most vulnerable, it's not worth doing. And so we had to add them. You know, men who were just coming out of prison, another hard population to track. Partners insisted on it. It was another month-to-month debate whether we could afford that. And we did it. So we really wanted to make sure that this was, important. This was important to the partners, even if the science was going to get sort of a little fuzzier. The survey staff recruited the community, but community was there at every step of the way, going to visits to the agencies. This pulse study would not have been possible without the partnerships in terms of the types of agency we're recruiting. A lot of very Afrocentric agencies in South Los Angeles that would have not ever had a researcher come through their doors and not allowed us to do the work that we were doing without the trust and respect that an agency like Healthy African American Families had had. How do outcome measures? We can't just have depression. They really wanted to look at employment and housing as outcomes. Does this improve likelihood of retaining housing? Does this improve employability, especially since this took place during the biggest financial crisis in the last, 100 years? To track depression services, where are people actually getting care for depression? Where are they getting counseling? Where are they getting their support? So we asked clients this. And also, we really wanted to look at suicidality because this was a big, important issue that our partners thought would be an important issue to talk about. And this really cost a lot more money. We had to get another grant. I've got 2 minutes, so I'm going to go through this. Everything was partnered, two-way exchange and everything. We fell about a year behind because of this in our grant. But we're doing okay, actually. This is from So I'm gonna get to the numbers. There were two communities engaged, Hollywood and South Los Angeles. They're actually called SPA 4 and SPA 6, service planning area, about 2 million people. We have about 103 programs and 350 providers recruited across both SPAs. We've currently, actually this has gone up since the last time I checked. It's about 3,000 screened, and we have about close to 700 who are enrolled and have completed our one-hour baseline survey. Actually, no, it's about, no, 600, right? It's interesting, you know, most of the sample is 94% of the sample is Latino and African American, and 95% agreed to the screening for depression, which consists of the PHQ-9. Very surprising, because a lot of the people said we wouldn't be able to get people to participate, especially poor people, especially poor people of color in, you know, these agencies that serve primarily minorities. And it's actually worked out really well. 92% of the people were depressed who enrolled, and 65 completed baseline surveys. One of the stark figures that we've had at in this is that 33% had probable depression, which is a PHQ-9 score of 10, for those who are familiar with the PHQ-9. It's the most common measure of depression in the world. And 15% of those who are enrolled actually have suicidal ideation. We have a protocol where we're supposed to call everybody, and I've actually called probably about 40% of them and talked to them and use our protocol. The win-win, even the consumers or the clients have had a community benefit. Everybody screened receives a resource guide where they can go, where we compile the resource guide for each service planning area. And then I've actually personally called at least once or twice almost about 40% of the people with suicidal ideation to tell them where they're going. So I just want to give what are the implications for healthcare reform. Parity and healthcare reform are about improving social justice in healthcare, but can underserved communities and those with behavioral health conditions understand and benefit. Even with healthcare reform, how are you going to build a network to treat things like chronic diseases where there is no infrastructure to do so? And it's going to take about a decade for these infrastructure, at least, or more, for this infrastructure to be built. And even if it's built, are people who are going to be using them trust the resources that you know these county and state governments use? And so one of the questions that we have is maybe this is the way that you deliver healthcare in areas where healthcare doesn't exist. You go to agencies and trusted locations where people already go and try to build infrastructure there instead of building something that looks like it does in a middle-class white neighborhood. So that's it. Thank you.